First on Radio 4, here's Jeremy Bowen with a new series, Stories from a Momentous Year in the Middle East. Tales from the Arab Spring. Written and presented by the BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen.
Standing on an elevated highway now, looking down on what's going on. There's a crowd of a couple of thousand people. Water cannon spraying them. They're running forward towards the water cannon. They're chanting. It has been an extraordinary year in the Middle East. I have to admit, as a reporter, I didn't see it coming. One consolation for me, perhaps, is the fact that others didn't either, including President Ben Ali of Tunisia, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, and Bashar al-Assad in Syria. These three programmes are about some of the people who've been involved in all of that.
Unrest and revolution have torn through the Arab world because of overwhelming anger with dictatorships that offered nothing much more than corruption, brutality and unemployment. From Tunis to Tahrir Square and beyond, they lost their fear of the police and regimes started to collapse.
I'm on a road in Cairo called People's Assembly Street. It's more or less the equivalent of Whitehall. The Parliament's here. Number of important government buildings as well. And I came here about 6 years ago to interview the man who was then Prime Minister, Ahmed Nazif. And I was struck by one thing in particular. He looked really rich. He told me he'd been a humble professor of engineering, but he had a silk tie of really enviable heaviness and a beautifully cut suit. And he was pristine and groomed. I put it down to perhaps the fact he had a wealthy family. But since the revolution, it's become clear that he had a finger in a lot of different pots. He had a scam involving number plates, and he was involved, as well as that, in corrupt land deals. And he's now serving a prison sentence. In the old Egypt, the people on the inside of the regime had the chance to enrich themselves, and they were kept in power by a vicious and vindictive police state.
The Arab Revolution started in Tunisia, inspired by Mohamed Bouazizi, a young vegetable seller who burnt himself to death after officials confiscated his cart and his produce. Egypt was already boiling. The ruling National Democratic Party had shamelessly stolen an election at the end of 2010. President Mubarak's Western allies protested mildly. He was too useful an ally to be condemned. After all, he upheld peace with Israel and fought radical Islam. Egyptian campaigners for freedom despaired. Campaigners like Wael Abbas, back in Tahrir Square last month, who'd taken on Mubarak's regime over the internet.
I think the internet is the thing that started it all, because it was the platform where I was able to express myself freely, with no censorship, with no harassment, with no editing. I can post videos, I can receive comments from the people about what I wrote, their opinion, their reactions. It was even better than a printed newspaper, because you write something in a newspaper and you have to wait for the mail, for people sending you mail to tell you what they think of what you wrote. There is no way of interaction between you and the reader. But on the internet, it's much better. You can have instant interaction.
Yeah, you can have instant interaction with the security police as well, where they read it too.
Yeah, but they were not, back then they were not really that active. They didn't take the internet seriously. They didn't take us seriously. They saw that we were some kids in pajamas sitting in their bedrooms and trying to say smart stuff and talking to people of their kind, and we had no audience. But then they started taking us seriously once we took to the streets. Once we organized our own demonstrations.
Was it when you were arrested and when... I mean, you were badly treated, weren't you? They knocked you around.
Well, the arrest is the least. I was the least arrested of the bloggers, I think. But they used other techniques with me, like destroying my reputation, spreading rumors about me, attacking me online, hacking my website, trying to stop my YouTube account, Yahoo account, stuff like that. They spread rumors that I was a homosexual, that I was a criminal in the past, that I converted to Christianity. Stupid rumors that are aiming at destroying your credibility with the Egyptian audience that is still conservative. I have no problem with homosexuals or people who change their religion. Actually, I'm supporting their rights completely, but saying stuff about, like that about you in a conservative society like Egypt might destroy you.
Tell me something. There have been many attempts at opposition and consistent opposition from small groups of people, really for a lot of years, and demonstrations. And there was a proud tradition of opposition here.
Yeah.
However, it didn't get the critical mass until this year. What was different about this year?
Tunisia. I always say that. People ask me that, and I say that it was Tunisia that was the spark, or that...
Because it seemed possible.
It gave people courage to do something similar, because yeah, they saw that it's possible. Other people did it. This small country that beats us in football, in African tournaments, has removed its president. Why the hell can't we do that? Let's do it. And they did it.
Some people say it's the election. That was the last straw.
It's the elections, and it's many things,
the fixed election in December 2010.
The thing is that they felt that they have achieved what they want. I mean, the Mubarak regime. They felt that they have reached all their goals, and they have overdone it. They have forged the election to the extent that they had most of the seats. There were almost no seats for the opposition. It's ridiculous, especially with a regime that tries to tell the West all the time that we are democratic, we have opposition, we have, you know, so and so.
So it was contemptuous.
Exactly.
They didn't have to cover up what they were doing.
They didn't care.
So that was the last straw. And then there was Tunisia.
Yeah, yeah.
And people thought, well, we're angry, why don't we do something about it?
I have reached a point when the elections ended and the majority of the seats, or most of the seats, went to the National Democratic Party. I was feeling hopeless. I felt completely disappointing. I was thinking about leaving the country. But suddenly there was Tunisia and...
Bouazizi
and...
set himself on fire. It all started.
Exactly. And then Ben Ali was removed. Because I personally did not think that it was going to continue and succeed too. Because there were several uprisings in Tunisia. I have lots of Tunisian friends, activists and bloggers. And I thought it was going to end eventually like that. But when they removed Ben Ali, it was something.
When did you think, at what point back in January did you think, hang on a minute, we've got something here, Mubarak is going to go?
It's on the 25th.
Day of the first big demonstration,
If you ask me the day before, I would say it's going to be the same 25th of January like every year. A few demonstrations against torture and police brutality, and that's it. But this year it was different, it was big. Even that night, I wasn't so optimistic because they managed to evacuate the square. They threw gas and...
Yeah, they made it here to the square that day. And there were some clashes in the square.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. And we all left. On the 25th, we all left. And the police had the upper hand. But the next few days, and the Friday of anger...
28th.
The 28th. It was completely different. 28th, I knew that this something is happening now.
I was on the streets in Cairo on that day. The place is absolutely crawling with plainclothes police, with uniformed police. We're moving away to try and get a better vantage point, because from here to try and do any reporting is to get arrested. It was a Friday, and I got up to a roof overlooking the mosque where Mohammed al-Baradei, one of President Mubarak's earliest challengers, was praying. Riot police with shields and clubs stood shoulder to shoulder, ringing the packed mosque in a direct challenge to the worshippers, which was taken up.
Chanting has started down there now. The prayers are over. The secret police arrived on the roof. I think my colleagues have been arrested. I'm just going ahead of them down the stairs, trying to get our material, our pictures away. Someone must have tipped them off. We did try to be pretty discreet there, though. But we stick out, we're foreigners. If it's this hard for us to operate, imagine how difficult it is to be a member of the opposition.
Our tapes were hidden in my sock, and the clashes were spreading.
Standing on an elevated highway now, looking down on what's going on, there's a crowd of a couple of thousand people, water cannon spraying them, they're running forward towards the water cannon. They're chanting, punching their fists in the air.
Allahu Akbar!
More people arriving, coming out of minibus taxis. Chanting and shouting, crowd are coming my way now, as is a bit of the tear gas. Water cannons working continuously, but they're not putting the crowd off.
The clashes spread across Cairo. Hundreds of police stations were attacked. The rage was driven by years of humiliation and fear.
Tear gas coming this way at the moment. The police do not have this demonstration under control. Wow. Where you get involved with tear gas? The thing to remember is don't rub your eyes because it makes it worse.
It's pretty effective stuff.
Some water here. Whole group of people around it. A man putting water into their... He's going to put water in my hands now. It's a bit better. We're all like supplicants here with our... hands cupped, waiting for the salvation of the water.
I'd been certain that the Egyptian police state was too strong, too ruthless to be beaten. But the 28th of January was the day when all that began to change. It was live on TV right across the Arab world, and people who lived under other tyrants watched very closely.
Past three now, and around where I'm standing on one of the bridges over the Nile, it's definitely gone up a notch. A police vehicle came up firing tear gas canisters into the crowd. There are people here with blood on them. They threw back a lot of rocks on the truck. They're more angry now.
People were dying. I saw policemen firing shotguns that sprayed buckshot into the crowds. But I was expecting more killing. Afterwards, I was told that the regime tried to order the police to use high-velocity weapons against the crowds, but the order was not given. Perhaps they doubted whether it would be obeyed.
Well, it's just before six in the evening, and the curfew is due to come in a couple of minutes, and where I am, nobody is going home. The major bridge into Tahrir Square, the central square, is in the hands of the demonstrators. The security forces have pulled back. There are burnt-out police lorries here. If this was London, it's as if demonstrators had taken over Westminster Bridge on the way into Parliament Square. It's that significant. However, now that a curfew has been declared, it means that later on tonight, the security forces could well be back.
But that evening, the protesters seized Tahrir Square and stayed. The people of Egypt wanted to regain control of their country. Ever since then, they've been arguing about its future. Not every Egyptian is happy that the biggest winners could be religious. The Muslim Brotherhood invented modern political Islam back in 1928 and spread the idea through the Islamic world. The Mubarak regime saw it as the enemy. Now, it's heading for power.
Going up a dark and dusty staircase in a very unassuming apartment building. And for a long time, this was the headquarters of the Muslim Brotherhood, the most significant political and social movement in Egypt. Outside the ruling party of Mubarak's day, of course. The Muslim Brotherhood was illegal but tolerated, and all they tolerated was this very, very low-key office.
It's now the headquarters of the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party.
Al Jazeera Arabic on the TV.
I've come to see Issam Al-Aryan, who's one of the Muslim Brotherhood's leaders. It's ahead in Egypt's current drawn-out elections. Mr. El Erian always insists that the Brotherhood wants democracy and won't try to impose its austere social values on others. Many secular Egyptians just don't believe him.
Nice to meet you again.
Good to see you.
You have a very hard work now from Egypt to Libya to Tunisia, then Egypt.
It's non-stop.
And then Yemen, not a stop. It's the Arab Spring is going to continue till Arab can convince the whole world that they are ready for democracy and that is the time to accept this Arab Spring and accept the results of the democratic process.
For almost 60 years, Muslim Brothers were periodically imprisoned, tortured, and even executed by the old regime. Issam El Erian spent a lot of time in jail. His last spell ended when his jail was busted open at the height of the uprising against President Mubarak.
All the time we're under pressure from the regime. Tolerated, but under pressure.
How many times were you in jail?
About 7 times or 8 times. I don't count.
Did they hurt you? Did they beat you?
Of course.
I saw you in this office on, I think, the 27th of January, and we did an interview. And then we tried to call you a day or two later, and you didn't answer. But then I saw you after Mubarak fell, and you told me you were in jail. They put you in jail again.
I was arrested before dawn in 28th of January.
So the day after I interviewed you, you were arrested?
The day after interview, and I was released by people who come to release their relatives in the prison afternoon and Sunday. This was the shortest term or period in jail. One night only in this prison.
So what happened then? What did those families do? Because that was just after the...
They broke...
The uprising was just starting.
They broke all the doors and took the people outside.
So they broke into the jail?
Yes.
What about the guards? Where were they?
They spent all the night facing these troubles from inside the prison. And then they give...
They gave up and they let you go?
Yes, because they can be killed. And we know, of course, that many prisons were broke.
You just followed them out?
We call our relatives also. They came later to be ready to transfer us because all the country was in a chaos and we can be killed in the streets. So our relatives come to the prison and transfer us to a city, safe city, and then our sons and more relatives come to take us to our homes or to our offices. I come to this office.
You came here to work? You came to the office?
To work, not to my family.
And how did you feel at that time? What were you
That the country is in revolution.
Twenty-3,000 prisoners, mainly criminals, broke out of jail as the Mubarak police state collapsed. Many Egyptians say the hated interior minister, Habib al-Adli, let them escape to fracture law and order and to justify the use of extreme force. He's in jail now, possibly facing the death penalty. The police were hated as the regime's enforcers, but the army high command told the protesters that they would protect them. I spoke to a serving soldier who wants to be anonymous as he's not permitted to talk to journalists. His words are spoken by an actor.
In the beginning, there was no plan. That was the worst thing. We just had to keep the country as safe as we could. Don't kill anyone. Don't shoot any of the protesters and secure the squares. Catch the criminals. Catch the people who were shooting in the streets.
Yeah, Cairo at that time was without law, wasn't it?
Anyone could do anything. Criminals took over people's apartments and threw out their things. They stole from the shops, the ATM machines.
There was a lot of theft, a lot of looting, wasn't there?
Yes.
I mean, I remember at night, we'd drive around at night in Cairo, and it was quite frightening sometimes because the streets were empty, and sometimes there were checkpoints, and you didn't know who was on the checkpoints. It was quite difficult.
Yes, of course, yes. There was no law.
So there was never a time when the army would have shot at the people? You had orders from the beginning?
From day one. Even my friends on the tanks. Because, you know, the army, it comes from the people. We in the army are protecting the country. The country means the land and its people. Because these people are our families, okay? Some of my guys, they were in the presidential guard. And when people started to go to Mubarak's palace and the numbers increased, these guys, one of them, he saw his brother on the other side. And he told me, I don't know what's going to happen if these people come through the barbed wire.
So if the crowds had come through to try to get into the palace, would they have fired on them?
In the beginning, they have live fire, okay? When they saw the crowd growing in number, they were ordered to put their ammunition away in their pockets. And he felt a lot safer when he did that. He kept telling the crowds that he was one of them and he wouldn't do anything. This is the day when Mubarak left. If anyone told them to shoot, of course they were not going to shoot. Because even if he shot these people, there were a lot. It wouldn't make sense. He would have run out of ammunition and these people would have kept on coming.
These days, there are protesters in Tahrir Square. And they're saying the big problem in Egypt now is the army. They've forgotten about January, February. Now they're saying that the army is not their protector. The army have to leave politics. Do you understand their position and what do you think about it?
They've forgotten what the army did for them. This isn't good. You know, actually, the soldiers are also with the revolution. And they want to protect the revolution because, you know, we saw our families suffering from the old government. They were happy that there was a revolution.
Are people in the army happy with the way things are now?
Actually, no. No, they are not happy.
Why not?
Because we want to feel stable. You can't satisfy everyone. Even if you do everything they want, they will ask for more.
I was back in Cairo last month. 42 died and thousands were wounded in protests in and around Tahrir Square.
They thought they'd beaten the old regime back in February. Now they think they have to fight it all over again. This crisis has been brewing for months.
Back in February, the military were considered heroes. The generals had given President Mubarak the final push and assumed power themselves. But the Egyptians who reoccupied Tahrir Square in November saw the ruling military council as the new face of the old regime, abusing human rights and doing all it could to preserve the special privileges and power the military had accumulated since it overthrew the king in 1952. The streets are more dangerous in Egypt now than they were before the revolution. One reason is that the police aren't there in the way they were before. They're still hated for the way they extracted bribes and handed out beatings before the revolution. I met Ahmed Abdul Monim Abu Yusuf in the police service's own well-appointed hospital in Cairo. He's the deputy chief of police for Mahalla, an industrial town on the Nile Delta. He says he collapsed from the effects of tear gas fired by his own men and because of the fumes from burning tires during recent riots in Mahalla.
For the first 4 days came a lot of views. They have nothing to do with the revolution. All what they wanted is to liberate criminals who are arrested inside the police station. These criminals ran away during the event of January and we managed to recapture them and put them back in jail. They kept throwing stones, they had swords and knives and everything, until in the end they almost managed to get through, and this is then we had to fire tear gas on them. Next to the police station in Mahalla, there is a fuel station. They were using this fuel to make cocktails.
Petrol bombs, Molotov cocktails.
Yes, yeah. So that they can actually throw it on our police station. We try as much as possible to reduce the damage and not to fire back on them until we almost lost the police station, and this is then we had to fire back with tear gas.
Have you had a lot of problems with law and order in Mahalla since the revolution in January?
What was happening in Mahalla was happening everywhere in Egypt. There is this hostility culture and the violence is actually spreading all over the streets. We did not have anything special than any other place in Egypt, but the main problem here is the general attitude of the people towards the police. We are trying to calm the situation down. There is no reason for us to elevate the situation. The reality is we have been attacked every time we go to the streets.
Is the hostility because the police was associated in the mind of the public very much with the old regime, with Mubarak's people?
For sure, there was a bit of hostility that is happening from certain departments, but that does not mean that we have to pay the entire bill for this small number of policemen who were not working in a proper way.
How serious for Egypt is this breakdown in some places of law and order?
This is extremely dangerous situation to have unrest in the country. The security is one of the major pillars of every country in the world. If we cannot secure the country, then it will be like the jungle. There will not be order, there will not be law, and then what you will see is what is happening now in Egypt.
A storm soaked the demonstrators in Tahrir Square the night before the first round of the elections at the end of November. Many rounds of voting stretch out into the new year. The final results won't be known until then, but it's already clear that Islamists are well ahead. In 2012, Egyptians need to agree a new constitution and elect a president. That is going to ratchet up the tension again. Allahu Akbar! The bedraggled occupiers of Tahrir Square on that wet November night saluted God's will, chanting that he is the greatest. But the young people still trying to invoke the spirit of February may be spectators while the real powers in the land, the military and the Islamists, collide over Egypt's future. Mazen Kandil, a young protester, tried to stay dry and cheerful.
People are united here in the square, you know, like tents are everywhere, it's raining above our heads actually, and the weather is full of rain. People in Egypt consider that as a blessing because water is something that's very precious, and it's like God is giving us a very, very a gift.
Less than a week after President Mubarak fell on the 11th of February, the revolution in Libya began. That's in the next set of Tales from the Arab Spring.
Tales from the Arab Spring was written and presented by Jeremy Bowen. And as you said, the producer was Mark Savage. And at the same time tomorrow, stories from the counter-revolution in Libya.